Argue, argue, talk, 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 exaggerate, argue, pontificate, argue, just talk, shut talk, up. Why won't you listen? Argue, why won't you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
Well, you may not be better off when you're spouting off all the time, but I think it's a good idea to spout off when there's something bugging you. And of course, you know, nowadays there is never a shortage of things to spout off about. Welcome to Spouting Off. I'm Karen Cataline, your humble host, and you're listening to BBS Radio Station 1. Today is February 5th, 2019, and it is, just for those counting, our 57th show of Spouting Off. Can you believe it? Even with about a two-month hiatus, because our producers sustained terrible, terrible losses in the Paradise Fire, still we have 57. This will be our 57th show under our belt. If you're listening live, we love that. We love that you're listening live. And call in the first half hour. If you got something to say, something on your mind, or something that I'm about to say that may just spark your interest. Now, I'm playing for time here because I'm looking for the number. It's toll-free, 888-627-6008. You'd think I'd know that by now, but I don't. So, let's go back to my, if I can get it over with here. All right. So tonight is the State of the Union, the much, much maligned and much look forward to State of the Union address. I got to say, I am not one very often to prognosticate. I mean, I don't know. I listen to lots of talk show hosts, and I love many, many, many of them. But the kind of talk show hosts that just simply throw out a question like, what do you think he's going to say? Do you think he's going to declare a national emergency so he can build the wall? Or do you think he's going to have messages of unification and all of that? You know, let's wait and find out. There's way enough to talk about rather than to prognosticate. Once in a while, something hits me that is a prognostication, that I make a prediction, but that's only because I've been watching the patterns, and sometimes I'm way off, but, you know, I'm a person that likes to watch patterns of behavior, and I am a student of what the left does, and boy, there's enough to talk about there. So I'll be watching, you know, popcorn in hand, as I watched to see Nancy Pelosi's Botoxed face and all the Democrats sitting on their hands, I cannot wait. It has been announced at this broadcast time. It has been announced that the kid whose last name is Trump is going to be a guest of Melania Trump, a symbol of bullying, and nothing could be, that is perfect. It means if they're going to be unifying, sure, but they never give up the fight. And that is a perfect example of how the people that have been lecturing us about bullying, bullying, bullying are the bullies. So I'm looking forward to that. So a lot on my plate, a lot to talk about. I want to tell you who our guest is, because that's going to be way fun at the bottom of the hour. After I spout off some about this, that, and the other thing, I am delighted to have with us Dr. Warren Farrell. He will be with us at the bottom of the hour. He has written a lot of interesting books, but most recently, the one that fascinates me is a book called The Boy Crisis, Why Are Boys Struggling and What We Can Do About It? I have been talking a lot, as you know, about the Me Too movement and how it has been purely politicized. I hate even saying that because the Me Too movement was politics. It was pure politics all along. But what they didn't politicize, the Democrats continued to for well over a year. And their goal? Well, their goal was to turn a formerly independent I am woman, hear me roar, adult women into victims so they could have the next victim voting block group or the victim group voting block. I've said it so many times, VBVB, victim broke, blah. Victim group voting block. And that is their pattern. Speaking of patterns, that's what they do. Anytime they want to co-opt a new group and they hope to co-opt as many as possible at the expense of a smaller group that they hope to make the perpetrator. Who are the perpetrators? Men, of course. Straight men, to be exact. And the victims are women. So, well, we were all taught when I was sort of coming of age that we were, you know, absolutely invincible to hear Helen Reddy sing about it. And we could do anything a man could do, including become a Navy SEAL, which was, I think, is preposterous. Just watch the Demi Moore movie and tell me that that is reasonable. This was, remember the times during Billie Jean King when she was playing against Jimmy, I don't know his name. I forgot his name. He is deceased. And there was a big women against men thing. And of course, he won. You know, someone might call and tell me who the name of that tennis player was. It was the player, the tennis match of the century. So anyway, we will have Dr. Warren Farrell with us. And I'm delighted to hear what he has to say. I'm looking forward to it. And we've talked about a little bit about the State of the Union. I hope you'll be watching. I was pleased that at least one talk show around the country asked for my opinion. And I just hate giving my opinion. Oh, do I hate it. And I'm going to be giving my opinion tomorrow. So I'll be taking notes about the State of the Union and looking at the body language. That'll be fun to look at all of those things. I'm sure that the camera will be on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who would like to tax the football owners who did not hire Colin Kaepernick at 70%. That's not vindictive. That's not social engineering. That's not socialism, right? Oh, yes, yes, and yes. Okay, so the first thing I want to tell you about is that I have now had my maiden voyage into Twitter hatred. I filled in for the wonderful Jimmy Lakey on 600 KCOL in Northern Colorado yesterday. And I talked about it a little bit, but I didn't talk about it a lot because I didn't want to be, you know, a victim. I don't want to be, oh, poor me. But in fact, it has been very, very educational. People warned me that when I put out my town hall piece called Why I Reported the case of an 11-year-old drag queen to Child Protective Services, I was told, you are really going to have it now. Now you're going to get the real haters coming out of the woodwork telling you that you're a racist, a bigot, a homophobe, and anti-trans and everything else. And sure enough, if that wasn't the case, I was amazed at what I encountered, though. People sort of were jumping on the bandwagon. It was really good for my Facebook shares on Town Hall. And you can still get that article either on my website, KarenCataline.com. Just know how to spell my name. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook and all of that. That's pretty much all the social media I care to do. Or you can just Google Town Hall, Karen Cataline, and look for that article. I've written about 8 for Town Hall. They are wonderful. They publish my stuff, and a lot of other people have too. It's been quite the education. Getting back to the 11-year-old drag queen. I'm not going to go into the whole story. Maybe I will in the future, but Desmond is amazing. It was a story that came out around the holidays simultaneously with Drag Queen Story Hour, which is a program all over the country where adult drag queens read stories to children aged 2 to 8. Now, as a libertarian-leaning person, you'd think I'd think that was just fine. But I don't, because I know what they're after. And what they're after is the indoctrination of children. And exposing children to all kinds of sexualization and, well, not all kinds of sexualization, certainly displaying a child as a drag queen on Good Morning America, which was the story of Desmond, and what I wrote about, is appalling for a whole host of reasons. Read my book called Fatlash, Food Police, and the Fear of Thin. No, this whole show is not one big plug, but I'm starting to amass more content. And, you know, when the brain is working, you want people to read your stuff. So that's what I'm hoping anyway. excuse me. So when I put out this piece about a week ago now, why I reported the case of the 11-year-old drag queen to Child Protective Services, I was likened to a Nazi, to a transphobic. They threw every name in the book at me, pretty much, and they never addressed the disagreement. The left, so many of them, have been rewarded and incited to go directly to ad hominem attacks without even skipping a beat. They don't even skip a beat. They just decide that if you disagree with them, you must be evil, you must be a bigot. I was called Hitler, and I said to them, you know, I don't get offended too terribly often, but that's incredibly low and offensive. I'm Jewish. I don't really like to use that as a defense. And what did they do? Did they say, oh, I'm sorry, I kind of jumped there? No, they doubled down. They doubled down, and they posted on Twitter a yellow star with the word Juden on it, and how Jews turned in their own, and how I am doing Hitler's work. But that was just disgusting. But even more so towards the end of this interaction was when they decided that because what I wrote sounded somewhat similar to another post they saw somewhere else. Mind you, there's billions and millions and trillions of posts on the internet about any subject you can think about. But somehow what I wrote that came out of my head and my heart was similar to something someone else wrote that they said was a pedophile. So now I was called a pedophile for being concerned that Desmond, an 11-year-old on Good Morning America, might be vulnerable to pedophiles. Can you make this stuff up? No, you can't. Now, the moral to this story, it's very immoral story to begin with, is that they disappeared as quickly as they came. I made the decision that for the most part I was going to respond when I could. And then eventually I blocked them because they were irrational and hysterical and I couldn't reason with them. That made them mad, so they created new Twitter handles, I guess, and started telling me that I owed them an explanation for why I was quoting a pedophile, which of course I absolutely did not do. Oh, by the way, they also reported me to NYPD and the FBI and the radio station on which I was guest hosting that day to tell people that they should beware of me because I have an opinion that's different from theirs. In the last case, they actually did me a favor because that station is run by wonderful Christian people who probably are, you know, every bit as appalled by the story as I am. In fact, I would venture to guess that they are. So it was ridiculous. But then just when I was getting into it, and I'll tell you when they all disappeared, it was when I was going to guest host for Jimmy Lakey, and I invited them on the radio and I said, just keep it clean and tell me what you think. You know, call me on the radio. I want to know what you have to say. All of a sudden, the whole Twitter feed disappeared. Fascinating, isn't it? So people have told me before that they are indeed cowards, and here was a perfect example. I want to move right along to a topic that has been on my mind and which I mentioned in my Facebook little tease about this show today before we welcome our guest. We are broadcasting this not only the day of the State of the Union that was delayed about 2 weeks, but this ongoing story about the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam. Now, the moment I heard, for those of you who may not be around up on this, if you're listening live, you know very well what's going on. But if you're listening in podcast, I'll remind you of the story because it might be a little late, but it is still relevant to what is going on. So the governor of Virginia came out in an appalling, reprehensible, repugnant video in which he basically, you cannot interpret this any other way, he advocated infanticide. That's all you can really say. He said, and I will remind you, when asked about post-birth abortion, which is what it was, that, the baby will be kept comfortable, will be laid somewhere on a table while two doctors and the mother decide what to do. In other words, whether they decide to kill this baby or not after it's been born. Now, one of my first reactions was, this is the same left that would move heaven and earth to adopt a puppy, but they don't have a problem killing a baby that has just been born. This is the moral compass, the broken moral compass of most of the left. It's just beyond explanation. Almost immediately, a photograph came out claiming that one of the people was Governor Northam, and one person was in blackface, and the other was in a KKK sheet. Now, this is the left's favorite topic. Anyone, everyone, anyone who says anything they don't like is a racist, part of the KKK, part of Hitler, and they are the bigots, ladies and gentlemen, they are. And we see examples of this again and again and again. But when all of this came out, my first reaction was, well, they don't even mind the embarrassment of this photo because they know the entire country, with the help of a corrupt media, is going to debate whether this was him and whether it's a good idea, and they can get the story of infanticide off the table. Because even though some leftists believe in that story, they don't want to have to defend it. And that's probably why they want to get rid of Governor Northam. And a lot has happened since then. The lieutenant governor who was elected separately, who happens to be black, also has his own problems with sexual harassment and this, that, and the other thing. Whenever you want to get rid of anybody you don't like, you just accuse them of sexual harassment. In this case, I haven't looked into the story because I didn't want to really get roped into the manipulation of talking about the story, when in fact the real story the left doesn't want to talk about is the one I want to, and that is abortion. Now, full disclosure, for the longest time, for a host of reasons, I have been pro-choice. I was pro-choice, mostly on the libertarian grounds that, well, there are a lot of things I find appalling. I don't want the government forcing people to either do it or not do it. I don't want the government making moral determinations. And then people always say to me, well, they make moral determinations every day. They are against murder. No, that has to do with the preservation of freedom, of individual freedom. Then we get into the perennial discussion on talk radio that everybody has and then avoids, but mostly it's been discussed and discussed and discussed. And that is the baby in utero a person that deserves protection from the government, the protection of life, liberty, and property, or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Well, on principle, yes, I believe that. However, you have a life within a life. And so whose freedom and whose life is really important here? Not important, but whose life? I'm trying to do this quickly because I really only have about 10 more minutes. whose life is I can't even think of the word, but you know what I'm talking about. I'm going to move on. This discussion is an important one, and I finally narrowed it down until recently to the first trimester. I still struggle with that because I would rather pro-lifers make the case in the bully pulpit and convince people than make it illegal, just because there's a lot of things I don't think should be illegal. But on this score, when this happened and when the Democrats didn't even want to argue the discussion on the playing field of baby killing, I had had enough. And I said on talk radio, I will say right now, I'm saying on talk radio that this case right here, regardless of whether the left wants to shift the discussion to racism, 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 and whether a photo is racist. Meanwhile, it's really okay for this guy to advocate the killing of babies. Does he get tons and tons of money from Planned Parenthood? You bet he does. And so this case, in my opinion, is going to create a whole new group, a whole new, shall we say, population of pro-lifers. And I'm pretty much there. Why? Because we talk all the time about the slippery slope, and people laugh and scoff and say, well, but that's the slippery slope argument. In the case of the current American left, the slippery slope argument is exactly the one we ought to be making because we're watching it. We're pretty much down at the bottom of the cliff when you talk about killing babies after they're born. I have a problem with killing babies while they're in the birth canal, okay? I have a problem with killing babies in the third trimester and, frankly, in the second trimester. But you see how this works. Once you accept that it's okay to kill a baby after it's born, it's only a hop, skip, and jump to killing the senior citizens because it's too expensive to take care of them. And I have a post on my website, which my Facebook page, which I just really, really want you to go watch if you can. Maybe there's a way to search it if you're watching, if you're listening to this 2 months later. But there is a video of a young man testifying in front of a Democrat or a committee, a congressional committee, about this very thing, about euthanasia. And he happens to be a boy, I'm just like, I don't know, I'm mentally dead today. Go to the video. All of a sudden, you know, it must be the 97 hours of talk radio I've been doing lately. But nonetheless, this video of a Down syndrome, that was the word I wanted, the Down syndrome kid, about 25 or so, who's been in media and was an actor. It's the most heart-wrenching video I've seen in a long time. And he's pleading for life. He's pleading for the respect of life. That no one ever had to convince me of. The respect for life. These policy issues, as we watch the left being exposed for selling baby parts, for disrespecting life, and then having the gall, the chutzpah, to lecture the rest of us about danger and health and the moral, whether it's moral or not, to have a wall to keep our boundaries on the southern border and to protect American citizens and to have American sovereignty, if all of that is immoral. And these are the people who are lecturing us about morality. One of the reasons why I don't like those kinds of discussions when it comes to the role of government, I think those discussions belong in the bully pulpit. They belong in persuasion. They belong. I am a very strong proponent of limited government because I don't think the government is moral, nor should they be charged with that particular responsibility other than what they are supposed to do, which is to protect the life, liberty, and happiness, or the pursuit of happiness of the rest of us. in this particular case, it is the job of the state to protect life. And one of its first obligations is to protect American sovereignty. And here you have Democrats jumping up and down about what is moral and teaching the young that open borders are somehow moral, while they ignore, avoid, and try to change the subject about infanticide. You see how all this stuff works together? It does. So I have some friends who are just beginning to welcome me into the fold of the pro-life stance. And I still struggle with that first trimester, I'll be honest with you. But on the other hand, the left is not a group that I want to be making these determinations. It is clear that they will never stop. They will never quit. They will continue to push the envelope until they have desensitized people in general from respecting life. I urge you to go to that video. You can probably find it at our break. I'll try to have that for you just so you can listen to it, watch it. I don't care if you watch it at my website or wherever you watch it, but it is so powerful. Not only does this young man, and I apologize for not having his name at hand, talk about and plead for the respect for life and the respect for Down syndrome kids, he talks about how happy they are and how happy it makes them to make others happy. But respecting their lives and not playing God serves those of us who don't happen to have Down syndrome more than anyone else. It reminds us of what boundaries, where the boundaries are between us and our Creator. And I'm not that religious or anything, but when the left tries to play God and tells us what is moral and what is moral in terms of protecting this life and not that life, they don't seem to care about innocent life that is being mowed down and murdered by people not vetted coming into our country from terrorist countries. They seem to have great hatred great hatred for this country and the principles on which we have stood. So to trust them with this, I don't think so. It's not a hard jump for me to make. I already made it with regard to the third trimester, the second trimester, and now I'm sort of at the first trimester, and I would rather stand with people on the pro-life stand, and they all have disagreements too, than I would a left that very frankly is like the party of death today. That's who and what they are. They are the party of death. It gives me no pleasure to say that. I don't like saying that, but it cheapens life. One of the greatest things I've heard in a long time in the argument for the death penalty, and these are tough issues, these are some of the most important issues that we face, is why is it okay then for the state to employ the death penalty when or if you are pro-life or you claim to care about life? It's very simple, and Dennis Prager said it better than anyone ever has. When you are kind to the cruel, you will be cruel to the kind. When you are kind to the cruel, you will be cruel to the kind. Furthermore, it cheapens life. If a mass murderer can get away with killing innocent life, why shouldn't he pay with his life? Not because we're vindictive and angry, but because he shouldn't be allowed to breathe when he's snuffed out the lives and the ability to breathe of others. It's not an emotional issue as much as it is a justice issue. Now, yeah, should it be anything other than murder? I don't think so. Not really. I don't. Should it be absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt that the person did it? Well, sure, it should. But should a mass murderer live while he killed so many And meanwhile, the same people that stand up for that issue have no problem with killing an innocent baby that was just born. We're living in an alternative universe. I will leave you with this, and then we're going to take a break. I just posted today my latest blog post that asked that very question. Are we living? Is the left trying to create an alternate universe? And I say yes. Please take a look at that article at my website, KarenCataline.com. When we come back, and after I get my brain about me and my brain cells gathered up, we will have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Warren Farrell and the war on boys and men. Stay with us.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/AskAuntEmma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/AskAuntEmma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
Hi, I'm Corinne, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is president of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the threat of bureaucratic despotism.
One of the chief sponsors of the Dodd-Frank finance reform bill called that legislation, quote, about as important as it gets, because it deals with every single aspect of our lives, end quote. And how does this legislation deal with every aspect of our lives? In the most unconstitutional way. It sets up a board called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has the power to regulate our economic transactions independently of both the President and Congress. In other words, permanent government employees are placed in charge of us beyond the control of those we elect, the control of we the people. This is a violation of the representative form of government without which there can be no constitutional government.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
And welcome back. Karen Cataline with you, and you're listening to Spouting Off here on BBS Radio Station 1. I am delighted to have with us, hopefully he is on the air now, on the phone with us, Dr. Warren Farrell. Are you there, doctor?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can indeed. I've got Wonderful. To give you a proper introduction. Just wanted to make sure. Dr. Warren Farrell is author of The Boy Crisis, Why Our Boys Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It. He is also, you are also the current chair of the Commission to Create a White House Council on Boys and Men. Also, for our audience, Dr. Farrell has been chosen by Financial Times as one of the world's top 100 thought leaders. He has many books out, two award-winning international bestsellers, Why Men Are the Way They Are, and The Myth of Male Power. Welcome to Spouting Off, Dr. Farrell.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to our talking.
Well, good. This is a pet topic of mine and has been for a while. Once the Me Too movement came around, and it was just slapping me in the face that they intended to turn all women into victims and all men into perpetrators. And you wrote this book, The Boy Crisis, Why Are Boys Struggling and What We Can Do About It. Tell us what drove you to write the book, and what do people need to know to buy this book and read it? Because I think everyone should.
Yes, I was speaking around the world on my other books, and teacher after teacher in Japan, Australia, et cetera, were coming up to me and saying, you know, the boys in my class are actually having more problems than the girls. And I was speaking at the, you know, in the old days, I was on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women. I was in New York City. I was the world's leading male feminist. So I was speaking pretty much from a feminist perspective. And then I was hearing that all these problems that boys were having. And so I was talking to my board at NOW in New York City about this. And they just weren't responsive. It was like they didn't care about boys and men. And they had this whole dichotomy. And the dichotomy was exactly the dichotomy you were talking about, of men as oppressors and women as oppressed. And that didn't feel right to me. My father worked his rear off so that I'd have the opportunity to write books and be, you know, somebody that he didn't have a chance to be, doing work that was more interesting than his work. And so I knew that I and almost all the boys and girls in my class had fathers that were hardworking, and they were anything but protectors. And there were, you know, men and boys, fathers in my class who were firefighters who were risking their lives, and one who, you know, died in his 50s from black lung disease. And, you know, and this just didn't ring true to me. And so, but when I tried to bring these issues up, instead of hearing, oh, yeah, thank you, Warren, it's really good to hear that there's another perspective we hadn't thought of, please tell us more,
boys, who cares about boys?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't care about boys.
They're the future men who are the future male privilege, progressive patriarchy, who, you know, will be. And their whole perspective was that the world was dominated by a patriarchy. And I said, no, the world wasn't dominated by a patriarchy. It was dominated by the need to survive. And to survive, our mothers sacrificed their lives in childbirth and sacrificed their careers if they had any interest in careers, or they weren't even suggested by people like guidance counselors that there could be a career that they might have an interest in, so it never occurred to them. Conversely, our fathers sacrificed their lives in the workplace doing things that they needed to do to make our lives better than theirs. And both parents had the exact same goal. They both were willing to make sacrifices to make their children's lives better. But to call women's sacrifices, and call fathers' sacrifices male privilege and male power, just does not fit the image of, you know, what Lenin says, which is that the family is a patriarchy, and, you know, that oppresses women. And that was not ringing true to my life experience. Well, taking that position then led to my noticing that in the 70s there were a lot of divorces, and with the divorces I was seeing that children were often not having their fathers. And my sister taught in elementary school, and she was also noticing that the children that didn't, you know, that had gone through divorces, that suddenly the children that were doing pretty well before were not doing very well afterwards. They were having psychological problems and academic problems. And that called my attention to sort of looking at how important dads were or weren't. And so the more I looked at that, the more I saw that dads were extremely important, and that the children that were doing worse were children of divorce who had minimal or no father involvement, the children that I came to call dad-deprived children.
Absolutely. I want to go back to something, though, because, you know, you piqued my interest in so many things you said. I am of you. It gets me frustrated some of the time that people, well, more conservative-leaning people, feel the need to have to defend traditional values, things that have kept America wonderful for so many decades. And this collectivization of gender, the idea that you are pretty much your gender, and I would even go so far as to say it's gender bigotry. I wish people on our side would say that. It's gender bigotry to hate someone because of their gender and to reduce them to nothing more than, are they, do they have two X chromosomes or a Y chromosome? So the people that have been lecturing us about bigotry, bigotry, bigotry really are bigots. What do you think about that, Dr. Farrell?
A, I agree. And B, it's we are very articulate on the issue of misogyny. We are not at all, most people do not even know what misandry means, which is the,
right.
the bigotry against men. And
yes.
But the fact that the Webster's Dictionary did not even incorporate that until the last decade, even though that type of bigotry has been around, particularly in the last 50 years and 40 years before Webster adopted that understanding that the hatred of men and the calling. So let me be really sort of personal about this. Since the Boy Crisis book came out about 11 months ago, I've gotten maybe 400 or 500 emails from fathers and mothers who are saying to me, you know, my son is in the seventh grade, and his seventh grade teacher is already saying to him that he's got male privilege and male power, and that he's part of the patriarchy, and that, and so he tried. So we've educated him differently, and we've educated him to be able to speak up. And so they're talking a lot about toxic masculinity. And my son says, well, you know, I think masculinity is more complex than just being toxic. And they said, you're just mansplaining. And so but they've just told him that part of toxic masculinity is not expressing his feelings. So he expresses his feelings, and then he's told he's mansplaining. And he feels caught between a rock and a hard place. And then from 10th and 11th grade children, I mean, from parents who have 10th and 11th grade children, sometimes younger, I'm hearing that, you know, my son is recognizing that that even though there's a world of equality, girls are not sharing the responsibility for risking the sexual rejection, that he has to still do that for the most part. And so, especially since he isn't really, you know, tall and the captain of the football team. And so but he's afraid to reach out and ask a girl out and then take her hand because he's afraid that he might be thought of as being a sexual harasser. On the other hand, he's tried being very cautious, and he's called a wimp. And so, you know, and here he is, he's not that mature. He's less mature than the average girl his age. And so here the sex that is the least mature is expected to risk all the sexual rejection from the sex that's more mature. So I find him withdrawing into porn. I caught some of on the computer, I caught him, you know, tapped into those sites. And so what I did, you know, so what I explained to the mother is that and the father, is that the porn is access to a variety of attractive women without fear of rejection. And when we set our sons up for such fear of rejection, damned if they do and damned if they don't, what we're doing is we're setting them up to turn to porn to be able to escape from that real-life fear of rejection. Instead, we need to be having a dialogue, not a hashtag Me Too monologue, but a hashtag Me Too dialogue saying, having our 6th, 7th, 8th grade teachers facilitate good communication skills between males and females and among males and among females so everybody can hear all the traumas and the trials and the tribulations and feelings that both sexes go through in an extremely precarious PTSD-producing time of life.
Dr. Farrell, one of the things that concerns me when I hear you talk about, you know, these issues.
Yeah.
I've been writing on these issues a lot. I'm a social worker. I'm like one of three conservative social workers in the country. And what worries me is that we concede too much to a preposterous, ridiculous left. I want to run past you what I've been saying on talk radio as a guest. And let me find out if, I mean, it probably doesn't help you from where you're coming from, but in the world of doing 10-minute interviews, 20-minute interviews, and I haven't written the book you have because I couldn't, it's wonderful. Here's what I say. I say that masculinity at its very best, in essence, if you will, is the very opposite of capital is the essence of capitalism and the very opposite of socialism. I don't think that these value changes that they're hoisting upon us are even things that they themselves, many of them, believe. There's a lot of bandwagon. People are jumping on the bandwagon. But for the most part, straight men are a target today because men at their best are competitive. They're resilient. They want to protect their families. They want to provide for their families. They want the government to get off their back. And they want to be an individual. And this is an anathema to the socialist collectivist notion that the government is your parent.
Yes. Yes, and the third, fourth yes.
All right. Let's not concede too much to them about how boys need feelings. You know what? I mean, boys have feelings. And if you respect them as a man, they have feelings. So, yes, go ahead. I'm very passionate about this issue, too.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Drives me nuts. Okay,
well,
go for it.
First, let's take the... When I did the research for the boy crisis, one of the things I found was that it exists in all 63 of the largest developed nations. And the word developed turns out to be pivotal. Developed nations are the ones that have incorporated to a much greater degree a significant amount of capitalism. And capitalism has allowed there to be enough survival at stake that a paradox has occurred. Where there was a lot of survival, their countries are allowed to create freedoms. So they created freedoms for divorce that they couldn't have created when the family was needed for survival at a much more survival-based level. They also allowed, particularly in the United States, freedom for women to have children outside of marriage, which was never an easy freedom back in the 60s and 70s and before that. And so today, 53% of women under 30 in the United States who have children without being married. Now, in that group of women is where dad deprivation tends to occur to a large degree. The boy crisis can be found, ironically, in those two groups of people, mothers who are not married, where the father tends to either not even be known or tends to disappear at a very early age. Those are the children that have problems. Those are the boys that have problems. Those boys, or in the area of divorce. So the irony here is that capitalism has created the freedom that has allowed people to experiment with the intact family. And the resistance that I met when I was on the board of the National Organization for Women in New York City was we want women to have the freedom to be able to have children without being married. But my response was, well, that freedom is wonderful, but the second you exercise your free choice to have children, you exercise a free choice to put your children's interests first, your children's needs first. They are your dependents. We call them dependents and children for a reason. If children do so much better when they have a father involved, then you need to take responsibility for that and make a decision to either have a father involved in a marital way. A marital way is important, not for moral reasons per se. It might be moral as well, but it's important evidentiarily because children who have a significant amount of father and mother involvement do far better on more than 70 different areas. They're likely to do better in every single academic subject, especially reading and writing, which are the biggest predictors of success. They're far more likely to have postponed gratification, good boundary enforcement from dads. That usually dads usually bring boundary enforcement to the family dinner table. And so the boundary enforcement leads to postponed gratification, which leads to children being able to succeed at their homework or school activities like practicing for football or baseball, and allows them to become either heroes the people who are willing to save us and risk their lives building our homes and preventing our homes from being burned down. But they're also the ones that heroic intelligence, which is what's been evolved for thousands of years, it can also today be supplemented for the first time with health intelligence. And there is a tension between heroic intelligence, which is intelligence for a short life, and health intelligence, which is intelligence for a long life. And we find that boys and girls who are brought up with both fathers and mothers are likely to strike that combination of heroic intelligence and health intelligence that gives them the best of both worlds.
That is such a brilliant academic explanation and a explanation of someone who really has done an enormous amount of research. What still concerns me, though, are you giving the benefit of the doubt to the people who are intentionally oppressing masculinity, coming up with terms like toxic masculinity? Because my point, and I think you agree, is that masculinity, straight masculinity, is a threat to socialism. And socialists don't want men to be healthy, heroic, or leaders, because that is a threat to the state. Am I off base here?
No, I think you're really on base. I don't know that it's conscious, although for the...
Oh, come on.
Well, I'm going to...
With terms like toxic masculinity patriarchy?
Those parts. And among the leading feminists, it is conscious because they have adopted a Marxist feminist perspective. And the Marxist feminist perspective, or the Socialist Workers Party perspective, is that the family should be destroyed.
So it's definitely
conscious among that group of people. Where I take it as to the unconscious level, a lot of friends of mine who call themselves feminists, they haven't thought it through at that level, and they just say, well, women were denied the right to vote, they are less than 100%, less than 50% of the leaders, and so on. So therefore men must have kept women down, and look at this hashtag Me Too, they're filled with men who are really toxic, but they have no understanding they're not saying, we really appreciate that men are, going out in droves when there's fires and risking their lives with black lung disease and so on, that a good friend of mine who was a firefighter did die from. There's no acknowledgement of the great contribution of masculinity.
Because there's hatred. There's hatred that is being whipped up.
And our 7th and 8th grade kids are being exposed to that. And it's not really healthy for a boy who's, reads books called The End of Men, or hears The Future is Female. Anticipating the end of men is it not exactly an inspiration for your son's life journey?
No, it certainly isn't. You and I totally agree, though. I see it kind of like concentric circles. I've used that term before, that there are people who are intentional, and they're whipping up these poisonous ideas that a lot of people who have lives and who are not, obsessed with politics and culture, as you and I probably are, that they end up on this bandwagon without really understanding what they are supporting. And so I agree with you wholeheartedly, which is why your work is so valuable, because it is to educate people who really had the best of intentions that this is damaging and dangerous to kids. I have to say, there's so many directions I could go with this conversation. I should have had you on for an hour. Around the Me Too time, I came up with this hashtag, which was We Aren't Victims, just to try and counter it from a conservative woman's perspective. And the last line simply is, we love strong men. We need them from women's point of view. There are daughters who are father starved. And there are women who are starved for strong, protective men. The dirty little secret is that women never wanted Ashley Wilkes. They always wanted Rhett Butler.
Absolutely.
And
as you know, in the Boy Crisis book, I talk about how, as confusing it is to our sons, because, if they're tuned enough into the world of media to know that the number one best-selling movie of all time is Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind!
You know, in which, you know, Scarlett O'Hara's character says basically no, no. And Rhett Butler says, I don't, you know, some version of I don't give a damn, runs her upstairs. And the next beautiful scene is the woman, you know, is Scarlett O'Hara's character being very happy. And so, now, if that was a man's fantasy, then you could say, okay, men, you know, have the fantasy of overwhelming a woman's no. But, you know, the fantasy is the female fantasy. And the more recent female fantasy is 50 Shades of Grey, which is also not about men being sensitive, warm, loving, open, tender, and kind to a woman.
Now, women have ravishing fantasies.
Yes.
There's just no doubt about it. And you just pointed out something I forgot about completely. I love it. And that is, in the very next scene, she's happier than she's ever been.
Exactly.
That doesn't mean that women have to submit to men all the time. It means that the stronger the woman, the more she needs a strong man.
Yes.
That's what I think it means. We don't have more than like 2 minutes. And I want you to give everyone an opportunity to tell them where they can get your book, where they can connect with you, and learn more about your work.
Absolutely. Thank you. The Boy Crisis book is available, is right now on sale at Amazon. They have a special sale on the books, so it's very reasonably priced there. If you have a bit more income in your family, go to your local bookstore, support them, and get it there. But if you read The Boy Crisis, make sure you focus on the how to structure a family dinner night, which is absolutely pivotal among healthy children. If you don't have a father involved, read the sections in the Boy Crisis book on how to get the biological father involved. And if it's absolutely impossible, look at the sections that talk about things that single moms can do when it's absolutely impossible to get the biological father involved. And most importantly, know almost by heart the 9 differences between the way dads contribute in their parenting style and moms contribute, so that you can work out a checks and balance parenting, which is what leads to children doing the best when they have both mother and father, and when the tensions between the dad-style parenting and the mom-style parenting are negotiated so that the children get the best of both.
I'll have to have you back on, because you clearly are homophobic. I mean, you know, we can't have two dads or two. That's a whole nother subject. I say that tongue in cheek. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I love your work. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a total pleasure. I really need someone who's so articulate as you are. So it's like I feel I'm meeting a colleague rather than doing a normal interview.
Well, that's an honor. I'm flattered that you say so. I talk about these issues a lot, so maybe we'll have an opportunity to be on a panel someday or something. Anyway, take care, and loved having you.
I love being on your show. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So just to wrap up, that was wonderful. I really had fun with that interview. I always have fun with the interviews, the people that I get to have on. That is about it for Spouting Off. Yes, I forgot. What am I doing here? I'm doing Spouting Off. If you'd like to get the podcast for the other 56 shows of Spouting Off, you can do so by going to my website, KarenCataline.com. And you probably know how to spell my name at this point, or you wouldn't have found Spouting Off. Wonderful to have you with us. Please connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, and thank you to Doug and Don for producing and coming up with great BBS radio. And thank you to my strong guy, HW, the guy with the IQ greater than that of a small soap dish. Tune in next week when there's going to be a whole lot more to spout off about here on Spouting Off.